All right. Welcome to another episode of the Joe and Doug Show. We're pumped that you're with us today. It's beautiful here in Youngstown. Joe is on the road. He is in Boston or New Hampshire today and just enjoying some family time. And I have a special guest with me today, Sam T. Sam is a Sri Lankan born naturalized American CEO, entrepreneur, author, thought leader, innovator, and aftermarket expert. He's also a husband, father of five, and an active leader in his community and church. I've known Sam for a long time, and I'm excited that he is with me on the Joe and Doug Show here at Youngstown Studio. Sam, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Doug, and I'm looking forward to the next half hour with you.
Going to be good. So why don't you just briefly introduce yourself, give a little bit of your background and journey, both in life and business, real quick for our audience.
Yeah, so I'm a naturalized American from the island of Sri Lanka. I came to this country when I was 22 years old. I started off by going to a community college and ended up at Oral Roberts University, where I got a four-year degree in marketing. Went to work for a company called Cardone Industries in the automotive aftermarket. And I worked for them for 12 years. And then because of a mistake that I made, I had to leave them. And then I went to, and did some consulting for myself for about 7 years, and then started a company called Parts Life. I started Parts Life in the year 2007. I don't know how many of you remember the year 2007, but it was an extremely difficult time to start a business. And the first three years, we really struggled. It was my wife and four children at that time, and it was a very difficult time. I tell people it was like I went to fish, and I fished all night and came back home with absolutely nothing. I did that for about 3 years, and then things started to turn, and here I am 14 years later. I have three companies. We are up to about 130 employees, and we're doing some great things for the Department of Defense by getting a lot of parts on very critical weapon systems and that type of stuff. So,
very awesome. And it's always an inspiring story to see someone come in and work hard and work their way up and educate themselves and do the things necessary to succeed. Do you consider yourself, the kind of the epitome of the American dream in that sense?
I have, Doug. I've never defined success like that. I'm sure that from an outside person looking in, it can sure look like that. And, if that means, having a house, having a wife, having as many cars as you have in the household, then I guess, I've achieved the American dream. But I would like to define success, at a much deeper level. And I would say much more wholesome than just the American dream. But certainly, we can go with that.
Yeah, no, that's so good and so true. So there's so much more than just the company stuff and all of that, but you really have a heartbeat to help people. And doesn't matter what industry, it didn't matter whether it was an encouraging word with somebody at church or in the community. So what has been kind of your life motto or mantra? What gets you up in the morning and drives you to do what you do?
Yes. So I would say a few things. Growing up in Sri Lanka, growing up in a Christian home, my mother had two favorite scripture verses. The first one was the fear of the Lord was the beginning of wisdom. And then the second thing she would always say to whom much is given, much is also required. And so a few years ago, Doug, I had attended a leadership conference. And one of the things that they had encouraged people to do was to work on your leadership model. And I thought, that would be a great thing to do. And so it took about 2 days and, working on different words and everything else. But I came up with my motto, which I practice, which is, it is to be able to create an environment where others can achieve their God-given potential. So I'm going to say that one more time, to create an environment where others can achieve their God-given potential. So I believe that that, you know, God gives people purpose and God gives people potential. That is not my job. But my job is to be able to create an environment where others can come and be able to plant in that environment and to be able to grow and to be everything that they can be. Right. And so that has been kind of the design, if you will, or that's the architecture in the way that I am living my life. And there are people who leave us. You know, there are sometimes there are people who work for us only for a season. And I'm going to be judged by how I treat that person while that person was working with me. So
that's so good. And I believe that too. I believe one of the things that a mentor of mine says, and I believe is that when I look at people, I see a 10 on their forehead. Everybody is a 10. And they have that potential to live up to that. They may only be living at a 2 or a 3, but if I can come alongside and help them, you know, tap into that full 10, because they're made in the image of God and they certainly have the potential to live in that space. I love that. So how does your current, you know, how's your book and SAMT Network and your company right now? How do you fulfill that vision in those different spaces?
Right. So I would say that I started SAMT Network to be able to encourage, motivate, and inspire young people, especially the underdog, right? Because for many years, especially being in Sri Lanka, I couldn't find my feet. I had got extremely reckless. I had got to the point where I wasn't, you know, doing the things that I needed to do. And at 18 years old, Doug, my father said to me, stop wasting your time and my money. And he asked me to go to work. And I needed to do that because I had built some bad patterns at my high school. And even though I was trying to make changes, some of those bad patterns kept showing up. You know, I had created a name for myself and I needed a change in scenery. And so I did that. And at 18, I went to work in commodity brokering and I did fairly well at it. You know, Sri Lanka is a tropical island, has a lot of spices and has natural rubber. And one of my jobs was to 3 times a week, I used to actually sell at the auction and I became pretty good at it. And that gave me the confidence to be able to go to night school. I hadn't finished my degree. I hadn't finished high school, but I went out and got a diploma at night as a way to be able to, because I wanted to see what I was good at. And I sensed that I was learning the things of business. I became pretty good at it. And that's what I then parlayed into, you know, coming to the U.S. and getting a job and working in business and industry. So I've taken a lot of the lessons that I've learned over the years, and I've applied it, you know, to life. And so they said about Joe Pa, the famous Penn State football coach, that he used the game of football to teach the game of life. I know that you're fairly close to the Pennsylvania line. I don't know whether you guys are Ohio State fans or Penn State fans, but it doesn't matter, right? I mean, these are two great rivals. And, you know, but going back to Joe Pa, they said that he used the game of football to teach the game of life. And that is exactly what my father did with me with regard to cricket. So I decided, you know, I lost my father 30 years ago, and I decided one way to memorialize him would be able to do what he had taught me, which was to take what I had learned from this game of cricket and to be able to apply it to life.
And that rolls into your book that you wrote. So briefly, the book is called The First 10 Runs of in Singles.
To an American audience, right? So let me spend a few minutes maybe talking about that. So one of the things I did, Doug, you've met some of my sons. You know, they played baseball at the Dream Park at Cooperstown. So when I first went to Cooperstown and I went to the Hall of Fame, I learned that baseball actually came out of two sports. I'm not so sure you know that. Baseball actually came out of cricket and rounders. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of baseball, or there's a lot of cricket in baseball, right? So there's a bat. You don't have a, you know, you're hitting with the bat, right? And you know, there's still a ball. The wicket keeper wears gloves. Everybody else, the fielders don't wear gloves. And so there is a lot of There's a lot of similarities, even though it's definitely a different game. But there's a lot of similarities when you're hitting, you're hitting on the front foot, you're stepping into it. And so I've taken some of those principles, like hitting when you hit, you don't stand in one place and swing the bat, right? You step into it with everything you've got. And it's a great way to talk about initiative. Right? It's a great way to talk about initiative. Initiative about getting a job, initiative about following a course of study, initiative about mending a broken relationship. In order to do that, you need to take initiative. You know, the Bible says that without faith, it's impossible to please God. Yeah. Right? And so what is faith? Faith is being able to take initiative. It's believing in yourself, but also believing in that something that you're going to be willing to do, putting yourself out there, not necessarily knowing fully well what the results are going to be, right? So what I did, I created 30 short chapters, and I took a lesson from cricket, and then I applied it to life as a way to be able to teach young people. And just like in Pennsylvania and Ohio, football is the love language. If you look at South Asia, where I come from, you know, countries like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, South Africa, England, Australia, cricket is the love language. And so I wanted to write to that audience, and that is why I decided to do this book.
Yeah, and I've looked at some of the Instagram clips, and I've looked at a few of the nuggets that are on your Facebook page and elsewhere. So a couple of the things that stood out. Now, you just talked about faith, and that's something Joe and I talk about quite a bit on here. And I really believe I'm actually in the middle of writing a book on the mechanics of faith, how faith actually works, because a lot of people talk about it in a very theoretical and kind of ethereal way. Like, it's more of a wish for most people, more of a hope, but it's really that initiative. And I like that word, because you're putting not just a declaration out there, but then your actions have to follow up with the thing you declare, and you're going to face some opposition. It's just testing your resolve to see if you're really going to continue to follow through. And so I really, really like that point. One of the clips I saw of you on Instagram, you were talking about adaptability. And you mentioned in the clip, you talked about adapting to technology. And you used the comparison. You said, it's not just about adapting, but embracing change that is the key. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think for a lot of our audience, 70% of people don't like change. We run from change. We hide from change. But the secret really is to attack it and to embrace it, like you were saying. So can you talk about that a little bit?
I believe that's where we grow, right? I was mentoring a young lady just before I got here, a friend of my daughter's, you know, and I was telling her the need for her to become familiar with being in unfamiliar situations, right? As human beings, we want routine. We want the same thing over and over again because that makes it cozy. You know, it's like that baseball glove that's broken in, right? Or it's like that warm pillow that we are used to, or that old sweatshirt that we love to sleep in, right? We like the predictable. But the truth of the matter is that's not where we grow, right? Where we grow is in difficult times, in unfamiliar situations, you know. And even as somebody who's a naturalized American, I had to come here when I was 22 years old and had to make a way for myself, you know. And that's a lot of positive things about it. New people, right? New foods, new ways of doing things, right? Driving on the other side of the road, right? All of these things, even though they are challenging, right? This enables us to be able to grow. And it's the great way for us to really be able to come to terms, and it stretches us, right? You know, our capacities get stretched, our abilities get stretched, and it's a great way for us to go through life. So even though it is something that we don't want to do, and sometimes we are forced to do it, I think it is awesome. You know, and I would say this, when I had to leave Cardone, when I left Cardone Industries after working there for 12 years, I had to sign a very restrictive non-compete that I would not work in the automotive aftermarket for 2 years. It was a very difficult time because that is what I knew for 12 years. And I had to go make a living. I had to go support my family doing something completely different. And I can tell you, there for a little bit, I was feeling sorry for myself, right? But as I embraced that, as I learned that new language in that industry, and as I learned how to do the things that I did not know to do before, I became much more technical. I learned how to do a technical sale. I learned about, you know, things that were measured like in human hairs. This was not who I was, right? Wow. But God actually forced me to be able to learn these things, because when my company actually turned, it turned in a product that I had actually learned in those 7 years. So wouldn't it be like God to actually give me something that, not things that I was familiar in automotive, but the things that I had learned during that 7 years of unfamiliarity, where I had to actually shed everything, all my strength and what I thought that I had achieved. I had to do that in order to be able to embrace this new thing. And I would tell you that today, you know, we have parts on an ICBM missile, right, that is actually shut out of a B-52. Would you know that if I had not embraced that 7 years ago and done what I, not seven now, it's 20 years ago, if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't be associated with the B-52 bomber today. But I can sit here and tell you very confidently that I am, because of this situation that I had to overcome, right, and to learn and to be able to hit it out of the park.
Wow. That's awesome. So you've mentioned several times in your responses, and I know our background. We worshiped in the same church for a number of years, and obviously I'm a pastor. You know, you've mentioned your relationship with God and how that informs everything that you do. A lot of times we get call-ins to the show, or we have a business leader Joe and I might be coaching, and they want to check their faith at the door, or they don't want faith brought into it at all. How important is your relationship with God, and how does that inform your business decisions and your model and the way that you lead?
Yeah, so I'm a Christian first, right? I'm not even an American first. You know, even though I'm proud to be an American, you know, I define myself as a Christian first. So that is very important to me, right? So I'm a Christian first, then I'm an American, you know, then I'm everything else, right? So it's very important how we define ourselves. And, you know, it's true, Doug, right now, there is a lot of people who are having a very difficult time with their identity. Right. You know, America has an identity crisis. We don't necessarily know how we were created, who created us, that God created us for a purpose. And the truth of the matter is, Ephesians 2:10 says we are God's workmanship created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which he has prepared in advance for us to do. It's my favorite scripture because I recognize that I am God's workmanship. You know, I don't care what somebody else defines me as. What I can tell you is that God has defined me as a workmanship. But the truth of the matter is, you know, even if you look at a diamond or you look at a blue sapphire under a magnifying glass, there are some blemishes. There are some mistakes. There are some things that we need to be able to get through, right? But the truth of the matter is God has knitted us together for us to be his workmanship. And then he has actually set aside work for us to do. He has specifically created us for that work, and we are the only ones who can do that work. And that's where the potential and the purpose come together. And so it's the meaning of life for me, right? It's the meaning of life for me that God has created me for a purpose. And he, you know, my days are numbered here, and, you know, he has given me things that I need to do. And it's my responsibility to go ahead and do that.
That's very good. You know, I know life for you obviously is far more important than the bottom line at the office. You've poured into your five beautiful kids. They're all now, pursuing careers, and couple of them did really well with football. And you've done such a good job as a father and as a husband. Talk about that side of it, because one of the issues that we deal with is, you know, we get a lot of questions on, well, work-life balance. Joe has 7, 8, 9 companies, and he's spinning a lot of plates at one time, and he's consulting, and he has lots of different offers. I pastor a church, I do podcasting, I guest speak. You get a lot on your plate, and I also have 4 kids. So how did you find the time to invest those values that were so important in elevating your career? And where did you take the time with your wife and your kids? And because most people look at successful people and think all they do is work. And there are things that are far more important than the job that we go to. So how did you do that with your kids and your wife and stuff?
I think in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon says, for everything there is a season, right? So there was a season that I needed to be at every football game. You know, I used to be at every Pop Warner practice even, right? Because I did not want to let that time go by. You know, today I am happy. I'm a rich man because of all of the relationships that I built there and all of the opportunities that I had to see my sons and my daughters do what they were doing, right? And I still have my youngest daughter is still in middle school, so we still have some of that going on. But I think, you know, first of all, as a man, I need to listen to my wife, right? Because she tends to bring that balance, you know. I listen to her, right? When she's telling me, no, I don't think you should be doing that right now. You know what I mean? It's a great way to be able to kind of have that person to kind of balance you out. And the nice thing is, you know, even though I worked, my wife worked from home. So there, my children were well grounded because they had my wife to come home to, right? And so she was like the COO while I was the CEO. She was the one who was at home taking care of business. And that was and we balanced out, right? We made things work. And we didn't have any family here locally. So my wife and I, you know, the brunt of growing our children was on our shoulders for sure. And, you know, it's not over yet, but I think we have done what we've needed to do. I think one of the most important things, Doug, that we can do is to love our children unconditionally. It's something that I learned from my own parents, right, is to love our children unconditionally. And we have done that with our kids. The way we love our kids is not based on performance. It's based on who they are to us, not because of what they can and can't do. So that's important.
That's so good. And, you know, I see your kids from a distance, but I also had the opportunity to, I think I was your oldest is, I think I was his first and second grade Sunday school helper and was helping in kids' church when I was in high school. So it's awesome to see, particularly Dylan, the young man he's become, and your other sons as well, and your daughter. Awesome to see what God can do with the faithfulness of mom and dad and the grace of God being in the mix of it. That's awesome. Yep. One of the things I like to ask when we have folks on, what's some stuff you're believing for the future? One thing I've learned as we've had entrepreneurs and we've had business people on, they're always thinking about five steps down the road. So when you're looking right now, you know, there's a lot of people that are saying, well, you know, the economy this and inflation that, and everybody's concerned. But one of the things that I see consistently is the entrepreneurs don't care who's in the White House. They don't care, you know, what the economy is going to do or not do. I mean, they're aware, but they're pushing forward with their vision and their passion, and it doesn't matter which winds are going to blow. They'll adjust their sails how they need to. So what are some of the things that you see in front? Maybe what are some of the things that you're believing, some doors maybe for God to open so that you can continue to do that which you've been built to do?
So we are waiting on a very large contract right now. We are hoping that we're going to win it. We have a lot of good indication that we will win it. And so we're just waiting patiently. It's been a 2-year process, and we are waiting to be able to start working on that. And I also created a coloring book about 5 years ago. And I created this coloring book because this was my way of doing the BHAG. So when you think in terms of strategic planning, a BHAG is your big, hairy, audacious goal. And my big, hairy, audacious goal was to have a component or a part on every major weapon system. So the way I visioned that was by creating a coloring book. And it's called JETS. I think it's called JETS. Plane, it's called JETS, ships and hovercrafts or something like that. But I created this coloring book, and it's actually sold on Amazon and stuff like that. We give it away to our customers. But it was my way of being able to vision, you know, where I wanted things to go. It was something that transcended even me. You know, this may not even happen in my lifetime, right? But one of the other things from a people standpoint, one of the things that I would love to see is every single person that works for me own their own home, right? Oh. I I read a book recently called Mystery of Capital. And in that book, you know, the Chilean economist talks about the fact that in a country like America, right, where we are still a capitalistic country, the way that you create capital for yourself, the primary way you do that, the first way that you do that is by owning your own home. Right. Even when I started the company that I started, when I bought the company that I bought, it was my home that I used as collateral as a way to be able to get the capital I needed to be able to do that. So in the last, I would say in the last year and in the last 18 months, we have helped over 20 people that work for us be able to become first time home buyers. Right. So this is something that I'm very passionate about, because now that allows them to be part of the American dream, that allows them to be able to assimilate. Right. And yeah. So that is very important to me. And then I read another book called Neighborliness, and it talks about what it means. What does it take in order to be able to fundamentally change society? It takes four things. Right. It takes education. It takes a job. It takes healthcare, and it takes a place to live. If you think about it, three of the four things you get when you get a job. When you get a job, you usually can afford to live someplace and you get healthcare. What you don't always get is education. So one of the things that I'm doing in my company is I've hired somebody to come and help me in learning to put together curriculum so that I can take a $12 person and turn them into a $15 person, a $15 person into an $18 person, and continue to help grow them so that they have abilities and opportunities to be able to grow in their work. And by doing this, right, you are building a stronger community. You are building a stronger society, because when somebody has a job, right, and they have a career and they have a career path and they have some work to be able to go to, this is a great way for us to be able to make society where it needs to go. So I am heavily invested in that. To be honest with you, that is my life passion, to be able to see, you know, the people that work with me and others, you know, to be able to live and to be able to achieve that God-given potential.
That's awesome. And it's got to be a good company to work for. You want to educate people, that the culture you're exuding, you know, through the screen, I think is an envious culture. A lot of people complain about the places they work, but there are great places to work, right now. You know, as you had, you know, take an introspective on some things, what are some things when you look back on your life that you go, you know what, I wish I could go back and do that. Do you live in a spot like that where you look at one or two tweaks that you're like, man, if I could have done that differently, some stuff would have changed? Or do you kind of look at that and go, you know what, it's made me who I am today. I'm going to learn from it and I'm going to keep going. What's kind of your take on that? Cause some people beat themselves up for their past and they always live in that spot.
I don't. Right. So because I received this type of love from my parents, that's the same love that I live in today, right? I believe that, you know, God has forgiven me for the sins that I've committed, you know, and he's actually forgiven me for the sins I'm going to commit in the future, right? And yeah. So the beautiful thing is that we need to live life in a way like we need to be like the GPS, right? The GPS doesn't necessarily think in terms of where you were. More important. I had a friend of mine who said that when you think about the rear view mirror and you look at the windshield, the proportion of the rear view mirror is so much smaller than the windshield, right? It's more important to be thinking in terms of where we are going. I have tried to live life with very few regrets. I'm sure there are some things in my life, there are some things that I have done that I'm ashamed of, there are some things that I feel like I could have done better. But on the other hand, there is so much more life left in front of me, and I want to make sure that I'm not missing those moments and I'm not missing those opportunities to be able to continue to do good things.
That's so good. And I agree. I've used that illustration before. You know, when you look at that rearview mirror too much, you'll get into an accident, something in front of you. You know, you got to be looking ahead. That's very good. What would you say from your book are a couple of, what's your favorite chapter that you wrote in your book?
So I would say I talked about initiative a little bit. So that hitting off the front foot is very important. But also in cricket, just like in baseball, there is a ball that is bowled. You know, it's called a googly. It's bowled like a leg break, but it turns like an off break. So it's hitting that curveball, right? And so one of the things I think about is I didn't come out of my mother's womb learning how to hit that curveball. Right, it was something that I had to learn, and I had to learn through failure. And so I talk about hitting the curveball or being able to discern that googly, and I talk about discernment, right? Discerning people, discerning situations, and discerning seasons, right? It's very important for us to be able to learn how to discern, and it takes time. Right, I see people that get caught up in all types of things that they shouldn't get caught up in, and it's a lack of discernment that actually causes that. Right, so it's very, very important for us as we go through life to be able to practice discernment and to actually learn how to discern. And sometimes you need help of other people to help you with that as well.
Yeah, no, that's very good. So we have several people, you know, I'm seeing some comments in different places from all over the place. We have somebody from Antigua, a couple different spots watching, and you do obviously travel a bunch. What are some of the distinctions between other places around the world and America? What are some of the not just, you know, obviously there's different food and different culture and different that, but, you know, are people generally the same? Are people generally after the same things? Or do you have to package your message a little differently depending on where you go?
Well, you know, that's part of being adaptive, right? To be able to, so in cricket, we talk about being able to play on any pitch, right? But I would say end of the day, people have very similar value systems, right? They want better for their children than they've had. You know, if you think about Maslow's theory of needs, right? It's the safety and physiological needs. And then you go to the higher needs. And I would say human beings, I mean, I've traveled in over 40 countries. And I would say that, you know, people in general, and I don't even have to qualify it by saying in general. I think people want, you know, to be safe. They want to be secure. You know, they want they want something better for their children than they have had, and, you know, that type of stuff. But I think what makes America great, you know, what makes America separate is, you know, they say that there are two countries in the world where capital follows talent instead of establishment. Right. So capital usually follows establishment. That means who you are, where, how you've been born, what school you went to is what gets you the capital, right? The US and the US and Taiwan are distinctly different, right? Who gets the capital is the people who have talent, not necessarily people who have establishment. Now, you've started to see some of that changing, but if you go back fundamentally and still look at the people who are starting new businesses, people who are doing extremely well, you still have a lot of people, people who are naturalized, people who have come here and have had to start all over here. You know, there are people who are like that, who become part of the American dream. I mean, I'm a good example of that. You know, I'm a first generation American. Yeah. And I have been able to achieve some things. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if the systems and process were not there in order for me to do that.
Yeah. How did COVID affect your particular industry? How did it affect your employees? I know every state was a little bit different. Ohio had some restrictions, but was fairly open. You know, my kids went to school in person all year. I know that's different depending on what part of the country and depending on, you know, different kind of governors. I know certain businesses were forced to close and had to close, and others were allowed to remain open. Did it affect your industry at all? Supply and demand, some of that stuff.
So we were very fortunate being a essential business that we had to work, and we made sure that we made We made sure that we took care of the people who were vulnerable, some people who had underlying conditions we took care of. We had family members with underlying conditions. We made special disposition for them, but the rest of us worked. You know, I call it the buffalo culture, right? The buffalo culture is the American buffalo. They say when the storms come, they come together, they put their heads together, and then they charge the storm. Right. So not cattle, they scatter and they get really hurt. But the buffalo, the American buffalo, puts its head down and they come together as a herd and they charge the storm. If you can think about that mental picture, that's exactly what we did. Right. We attacked the storm and we got through it. And I have to tell you that, you know, not only did we survive, we actually thrived during this time. And I can tell you a lot of it comes down to leadership, doesn't it? Right. Yeah. You know, I have to tell you, I was traveling in the country of Guyana once, and I was in something called the Kachur Falls, and I was in a plane, and, you know, there was a lot of turbulence, and we were in the clouds for quite some time. We were in a small plane, and, you know, there was a lot of turbulence, and there was clouds, and I couldn't see the horizon. But the amazing thing is that I could see the pilot. And because the pilot was relaxing, guess what I did? I wasn't afraid. I relaxed through the journey, even though I didn't see where we were going, and even though the small plane was going up and down, right? I got through it because my eyes was on the pilot. And if you think about leadership, right, you know, in tough times, it's very important that, you know, you need leaders who are able to get you through that. Right. You can't have people see you sweat. Right. You have to be able to be a leader at that time. And I can tell you that me and my leadership team actually provided that strong leadership to my team. You know, Doug, you've heard you were talking about my son, Nick. My son, Nick, became a fairly good quarterback in high school. But his sophomore year, right, there was a game. It was against Willingboro. So these towns are familiar to you. I think he probably threw about four interceptions. I'm sure if he knows that I'm talking about it right now, he'll kill me. But he threw about four interceptions, and he was young as a quarterback. Every time he came back, he was like doing stuff that was, you know, not right. And I talked to him after the game. I said to him, son, I want you to watch Tom Brady. Watch Brady after he's thrown an interception. Watch him after he's done something that didn't go very well. Right. And I was able to teach him to be cool cat. Tom Brady was a cool cat. Right. Even when Atlanta was beating them by three touchdowns. Right. He still was in the game. I mean, everybody else, including the owners of the Falcons, were actually on the sidelines ready to celebrate. But the game wasn't over. Right. So there's so much we can learn from sport. And one of that is, you know, we need to be able to keep our head, you know, and we need to keep our stomach in the game, right? We need to be able to, you know, be able to get through those difficult times. That's what leaders are meant for, right? Leaders are not meant for easy times. It's not, you know, ice cream sundaes, right? It's during tough times. And as you look around, you will see that I'm not so sure how many leaders actually led during that time. Mm-hmm. You know, and one more concept is, you know, you need, when you don't have data, you need assumptions. But once you have data, you don't need assumptions anymore. Now you follow the data. So in times of uncertainty, right, we need to have assumptions. We need to be able to say, here is what I think is going to happen as we head towards that thing. But then as more data becomes available, we need to be able to adjust, right? That's why sailing is a great example of leadership, right? We need to be able to adjust based on how the winds are, based on what the seas are doing, right? And, you know, I didn't see a lot of that, you know, in the leadership around us, you know, and that is so important. And that's why it's important for us to be nimble. That's why it's important for us to be able to think in a way that makes sense, not only for yourself, but for all the others around you.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And we adjusted a ton. I know, you know, church wise, we had to navigate, you know, being, we closed for, you know, almost 3 months and then reopening, how are we going to do that? And we had to, you know, I bought more hand sanitizer and, and stuff that had never been in the church budget before, but you had to figure it out. And, you know, you had to navigate it and you had to do your best to love people, and everybody had their various opinions, and you know, you did your best with what you had. But as a leader, you make the decisions that nobody else wants to make. And I think it was Steve Jobs that said something like, "If you want to make everybody happy, sell ice cream. You know, yep. Don't be a leader." And, yep. And I find that to be true. And the longer, you know, I'm into, the further I get into leading my church, the decisions they pay me for are the ones that nobody else wants to make. You know, if everybody wanted to make it, they would sit in that spot. Who are, you know, one or two, or three mentors or people you kind of, look up to, poured into your life? Who are some of those folks that you kind of, have modeled yourself after?
So there was a guy by the name of Mark Spuler, you know, who was at Cardone. I don't know whether you knew the Spuler family, but he poured into me a lot when I worked for him at Cardone. He was probably my strongest mentor in the workforce. But I would have to say that my parents, my father and my mother, my father was a military officer. My mother was a school teacher. They lived their entire life of service. And so, you know, I got a lot of grounding from them over the years. And then I have other guys like Joe Beretta, who passed away. You know, he was somebody that I was very close to that has mentored me. And there are others. You know, I've been able to surround myself with people who I've always looked up to and learned from.
That's good. And how about books? Are you a big reader? What are, you know, if you had a new executive starting with you, you would buy them these three books and say these are must reads for you?
So I am constantly asking, you know, my team to read. Currently, a lot of the books that I have my people reading are around government contracting, because government contracting is extremely complex. But there's a book called The Switch that I recommend, because it talks about how to lead during difficult times, right? It's called The Switch, and it's very, very important. It's a very important book. There are others. You know, Covey's books are good. John Maxwell's books are good. Mm. You know, I'm somebody who reads. I have a lot of books. I read a little bit here and there, you know. So I'm not somebody who features a book. I read a little bit here, read a little bit there, and then I put it all together.
That's so good. Well, we're coming to the end of our time, Sam, and I so appreciate you being on the show. If our audience wanted to buy your book or connect with you, where can they find you at? What's your website, your you know, social media, et cetera?
Yep. So the book, I'm going to hold it up here. The book is called The First 10 Runs in Singles, and it's available on Amazon. It's called The First 10 Runs in Singles. So even though you may not get it for yourself, because you may not be a cricket player, you may want to get it for somebody who you want to build relationship with, you know, who's from South Asia or from part of the world that plays cricket. And the best way to get a hold of me is samt@samtnetwork.com. And that's the best way to get a hold of me. And, you know, I'm on most social media. I'm very active on LinkedIn. It's primarily the way that I communicate today. When I communicate, I'm primarily on LinkedIn, because I am communicating to people who are in the workforce, and I'm talking to people about leadership and different things that go on. So that's the place that I like to write and to be able to see things.
Excellent. Well, Sam, thank you so much. And thank you, audience, for joining in this interview. I hope it was refreshing for you, and I hope you enjoyed your time with us. I'll be back here Thursday with a special guest in the studio, my friend Michael Lagares, pastor at Victory Warren. So you won't want to miss Thursday's show, and that will kick off at 6:05 live on Facebook, YouTube, and everywhere you get a podcast.
Thank you for listening to this show on Youngstown Studio. If you like our programming, we invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel, follow our Facebook page, or subscribe to your favorite podcast platform like iTunes or Spotify. This is original Youngstown content, and we would appreciate you sharing the videos and the word about us. Thank you.